This is an interview with Mr. Bert Dan on November 17, 1982 in Oak Park, Michigan. The interviewer is Kay Ross. I'd like to start the interview by asking you some questions about your life before the war. So, would you like to tell me when and where you were born?
Sure. I was born in January 9, 1916 in Romania. And I went to school in Romania. I was in the army, in the Romanian army in 1938. And actually, that's when the problem started out, in 1938, you know, when I was in the army. Then 1 year later in Poland, the problem started, and then they detained us and we stayed for a longer period of time in the army because of the problems that we're having worldwide, actually. And then in 1940, then the Romanian army started getting into the Nazi they didn't trust the Jewish soldiers anymore the way they did before, and therefore they were sent out to smaller little towns or communities where the population was in the army already.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm talking about people, non-Jewish people, and therefore the Jewish people were sent out to work on the fields and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked there for about 6 months or less. And
yes,
then
you were a soldier then? I mean, you worked on the army?
I was a soldier in the army, but no gun. The guns were taken away from us. And we were in there working on the fields for about less than 6 months. And then we were released. We were free to go whatever we wanted to. And then in 1940, at that time the Hungarians wanted a part of Romania back from the Hungarians wanted a part of Romania back that actually belonged to them before the First World War. And there was a decision made in Italy at that time, Graf Ciano, I'm sure that you heard of that the history, you know, that there was a decision made that a big chunk of Transylvania is being transferred back to Hungary, and that part where I come from was that was the city was Kolozsvár.
Could you spell that?
Well, I spell it to you in Hungarian and Romanian, so you will know exactly. The Romanian name was Cluj. It is C-L-U-J. And in Hungarian it is called Kolozsvár. It is K-O-L-O-Z-S-V-A-R.
Was that a large city?
It was a large city. There was a population of about 150,000 people. There was a university, and we had our own opera and theaters and so on. It was a beautiful, large city.
How many Jews lived there?
And there was, I would say, roughly about 12,000 Jews in Kolozsvár. And the Hungarians got it back in September of 1940. The end of September 1940. They marched in, and the Romanians walked out, and the Hungarians took it over. And it wasn't as easy as I'm telling it to you right now, but they got it back. And actually, when the Hungarians took over, that's when the real problem started, because the Romanians, I don't want to to sound like they were angels. They were by no means, because they had people like Mr. Trifal, who you heard of him, I'm sure, and there were many, many, many other Trifas in Romania. But generally speaking, I would say that the Romanians, in comparison to the Hungarians, were like meow comparison. The Hungarians were more of a Nazi or more of a Jew hater than the Germans themselves. And I really mean that. You know, it was unbelievable. Only people who actually lived there, you know what the Hungarians, the way that they hated with a passion the Jews. They actually hated them. And there was no way for anybody who wanted to make an honest dollar, you know, to make an honest living, there was no way. They wouldn't allow you, because everything was rationed, you know, and you couldn't buy anything, and if there was anything to be sold, or to anybody wanted to buy something, they gave it to the Gentile storekeepers, and the Jewish people had no way of making a living. So actually they forced the Jewish population into a sort of a black market. You didn't have to be a black market here, but indirectly they forced you into it, and which was a very unfortunate thing. And that's the way we lived. Now, my part, for example, in 1941, up until then I had odd jobs here and there, and in 41, in November the 9th, actually, that I remember very, very distinctly. I arrived by train. I was in Budapest, and on my way home, when I arrived in my hometown in Kolozsvár, I see my sisters. I had four sisters, and two of the four sisters were at the train, at the station. I couldn't figure it out why they are there, and I get out, and I just was crying out loud, "What are you doing here so early in the morning?" It was 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, and it was very unusual, because they never waited for me whenever I was away. They never waited for me, and this was an occasion where they did wait for me. And they told him nothing, just we wanted to come out to wait for you. And we walked together, and I didn't live too far away from the station, so we didn't even have to take a cab or anything. We just walked. And while we were walking, then one of my sisters told me that there are two gentlemen who are walking right behind us, and they were over at our house yesterday, and they wanted to talk to you. And they are right here behind us, so don't get panicky, and we don't know actually what they want. And they followed me to the house, and my mother, who was a widow at the time, you know, and she was an elderly woman, and these two guys walked right behind us, and they came in. When the minute I was at the door, before I even had a chance to walk into the house, they pulled out a gun and stuck it into my back, and they said, "You are under arrest, and don't make any move, because your life depends on it." Naturally, I didn't do anything, and we walked into the house, and they searched me without asking any further questions. They started searching me, and they took, I had a suitcase, a small suitcase, and they opened it up, and I had a small prayer shawl, and the tefillin, I don't know whether you know what that means. I had that with me in a pair of pajamas and a shirt and stuff like that. But they didn't find anything, I don't know, whatever they were looking for. And then they told me that you will have to come along with us because we have to ask you some questions. And they took me in to the police station and they started questioning me. And they told me that they have another couple of men under arrest who are not Jewish. And they stressed it very, very strongly. And they claimed that they know me and they will have to take me down there, which was about 250 miles away from there, from Korovar. And they want to confront me with these two gentlemen, because they have a lot of questions to ask after that. I said, I'm willing, perfectly willing to go down with them. I say, I had no choice, whatever they told me, I had to go along. And they took me down there, and there's two men that we were talking about. I never saw them in all my life. I didn't know who they were. One of them had a brother that I had some connections with prior to this year. It must have been about 6-7 months before that. I bought from him something, and evidently that's how the whole thing started rolling, that I was involved in the black market. So they kept me under arrest, and the other two guys were also taken, and they took us all to Budapest. And there was a trial. They kept us locked in for about 6 months without a trial. And there were a lot of people. They were brought in from all over. One of them bought a pound of coffee, or he sold a pound of coffee and stuff like that, you know, and they were all locked in there. And I think it was the end of June, and finally they came out with a trial, and they sentenced me to 1 year in prison, and I was locked up in one of the most famous Hungarian institutions. It is called a Chilog. It is like, in English it is called a star. The star jail, you know, it is like Jackson prison or whatever, you know, it is the star. And that was one of the most famous, you know, where they took all the criminals who were sentenced for life imprisonment for murder and stuff like that. And that's where I was locked up until the 19th of November, 1942.
It's almost a year from the day they first came.
Almost 10 years and one year and 10 days, mm-hmm. Exactly. I was locked up, and they released me without any hesitation, and I was a free man again. And by the time I got home one day later, because they gave me a ticket, you know, to take the train home, I got home the 20th of November, and at that point there were, anyway, they put out signs all over the city that every Jewish man who was born 1912 to 1919 has to go in and to a labor camp, but they give you exactly the place where you have to report, and the day, you know, every, like I was born in 1916, so I had to report on the 15th of December of 1942, which was about less than a month after my release.
Only Jewish males?
Only Jewish males. And I went in December the 15th of 1942 to a Nagybánya, it is called a Hungarian, in Hungarian it is called Nagybánya, before it is called Baia Mare, which was part of Romania and then changed exactly the same. You know, that was part of Transylvania.
Is that a city or a...
A city. It is a city.
Could you spell it? Either one, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it is, in Hungarian it is called Nagybánya. It is N-A-G-Y and then another word, Banya, B-A-N-Y-A. Nagybánya. And they kept us there in a tremendous big school yard for 48 hours. And naturally they didn't give us any food because everybody was in and we took food along, you know. And while we were standing around in that yard, I have to mention this here because it was a very interesting thing that to show the meanness of what was going on there. One soldier came over to me. Maybe I was dressed a little better than the next guy. And there were several many people and I wasn't the only one, but at this particular time, one soldier comes over to me and he says, "Come with me, I want to talk to you." And I asked him, I said, "Do you want me? I should take my suitcase along." He said, "No, you can leave it here with your buddies and you come with me and then you will come back." I said, "Oh, okay." And I went in there and there was I wouldn't exaggerate, I would say about 30 soldiers who were all designated to watch for, you know, for this people with guns and everything else. And there was one Jewish man and he was you only had to look at him and you could tell that he wasn't all together, you know, he was a little bit on the deranged side, you know. And they kept on beating on him and they told him to sing some Jewish songs. And he didn't, he was standing there and saying nothing, you know. And one soldier came over to me and he says, "Now you tell your buddy, who is your brother, tell him that he has to sing that Jewish song, V'tahe Libbeinu." That was it. Say, I don't know how they knew about that particular song, but they want him to sing with Tahir Venu. And I should tell him. I said, "Okay," and I asked him, I said, "Why don't you sing with Tahir Venu?" He looked at me, he says, "No." You know, he says, he didn't even say it. He just wasn't that he's not singing. And then he told me, "I want you to get a hold of him and hit him on the face and maybe that will change his mind." I said, "I am not going to do that." He said, "Do you know what it means that this is an order and you have to do it?" So I went over to this guy and I did this to him and I just slapped him. You know, I wouldn't hit him for, if my life would depend on it, I wouldn't hit him. And he said, "Is that the way you hit him?" I said, "Well, I told you, I am not going to hit him. If you want to kill me, that is your privilege, but I am not going to hit another Jewish man who is having the same problem like all of us, and I have no right of doing it, and I am not going to do it." He said, "Okay, now wait a minute." And one of the soldiers went over and he grabbed this man like this here, and hit him right in the face with his fist, that the guy fell down and started bleeding. And when he got up, he said, "Now you show him how to hit." And that, you know, as I told you before, you know, he wasn't out there, you know. And he came over to me and he got a hold of me and hit me in the face, but he knocked me actually out. And I wasn't a weakling, you know, either, but he actually, this guy was a heavy-set big fellow, you know. And he hit me that he knocked me down and I was bleeding from my mouth. And then, after I got up, he said, "You get the hell out of here in the U.S. of being, and they threw me out. The other guy was I left him there, they left me out, and I was glad that that was the end of that. And naturally, my friends, they all asked me, they wanted to know what happened, and it was unbelievable, you know, and like 5 minutes later, they came outside and they said that all the doctors and lawyers stay aside. And they told that the new doctors were coming, and all the doctors, and they ran, you know, in one group, and they were standing on the side. And they said, is there anybody who only has a couple of years, you know, in medical school? And there were another few guys who ran over, yes, we are medical students. And so they said, okay, all come with us. And as I told you, this was a tremendous big yard, and they had no facilities, you know, no toilets, stuff like that. And they went all the way back in the fields, and that's where they had to go. And they took all these doctors and lawyers and the students and everybody, and with their hands, they had to pick up that shit, excuse me for the expression, and bring it over like this here and throw it in the toilet. This is the kind of a treatment they started us out with in 1942. It was incredible, really. You know, it is, when I think back about it, my blood is actually boiling. It is incredible. And then the next day, they divided us up in groups of 200 each, and they sent us to different small towns, and they put us in a school building, and there was one commanding officer, like he was probably a lieutenant or a second lieutenant, something like that, and he was in charge of these 200 people, and he had about probably 25-30 soldiers, and they were naturally armed, and they are the ones who told us what to do, and they took us out, and we had to make all kinds of crazy exercises, like, and we were still new at it, you know, and when we left home, we took along food, and we took along our belongings, or whatever we had, and everything was either in a backpack, you know, or a suitcase, or whatever you had. And the 200 people were divided up into 50 each. So there were four different groups of 50, and we slept in different rooms, all 50, and one room 50, and the next room was not. And all of a sudden, some soldiers ran in during the night, and they told us that the American and the Russians are coming in, and everybody out, and don't take anything out of here, and out. And they gave us 1 minute to get out. You didn't even have a chance to put on your trousers or anything, just the way we were, we ran out. And by the time we got down, they made us run around and run in the back and forth and so on. And then by the time it was all over, it was just a test. So now you can go back in your rooms. By the time we got back there, all the belongings, whatever we had, was in the middle of the room in one pile. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Everything was empty, and they put it all in one pile, and they gave us exactly 2 minutes to clean up the room and go back to bed. We slept on the floor. And things like this here, I don't want to go into details, I just wanted to bring out the most important part of it, but this was going on and on and on almost on a daily basis. And we got to the point where you got used to it, that you didn't care anymore, didn't you? Know, we became almost like animals, trained animals who did everything whatever they were told to do, you know, and we didn't care anymore. So,
did they ever have you doing anything that was real work, or was it all just?
And then I'm getting to that. And then they kept us there for about 4 weeks. After 4 weeks, they divided us up, and they took like 100 of us. They sent us to a bigger town. It is called Nagyvárad. Or Oradea in Romanian, it is called Oradea, and in Hungarian it is called Nagyvárad, and there was a military school, and they put us in there, in that military school, and we had to take care of the cleanliness and clean up the yard and clean up the horses. They had a lot of horses and they had all kinds of equipment, so we did the cleaning up. And in comparison, the way it was for the 4 weeks in the beginning, we were in seventh heaven, because we had our freedom inside. Naturally, we couldn't go out, we were not allowed to leave. That was like a prison. But at least we had peace of mind, and we were fed very well over there, and we had no weird problems. And the other 100 from our group were sent somewhere else. They were sent to a cheek, as we call it. And there they were building a train, they were building the tracks. And they needed people over there, and the other hundred from our group went sent down there to build those tracks. And they had a very difficult, rough time, because afterwards, about 6 or 7 months later, we were together again, because they sent us to a place, it was called Szent Király Szabadja. And there was a tremendous, huge place where they were building an airport, an army airport. And they had there, I'm not exaggerating if I would say, 100,000 Jewish people, mainly Jewish. I think they had probably about 500 or so non-Jews that were also brought there, but the majority, close to 100,000 Jews were brought in there, and we worked out there building the airport. And
what was the name of the place again?
Szent Király Szabadja. It is a long, if you want me to mark it down for you.
Yeah, right up here for me. That was in Hungary, or was it part of Romania
that was originally Hungary.
Okay.
Can I mark it here?
Sure.
And we all worked there at the airport, and we were fed very, very poorly over there. But we had our freedom in the camp. We could walk around from one camp to the other, and it wasn't as bad as we thought it would be, really. It wasn't that bad. This was already at the end of 1943. And all of a sudden, they decided that they are going to release everybody for 2 months. They can go home. Yes? without any hesitation, they just told us that we are free and we can go home, and we have to report back on the 15th of February 1944. And we went home, and when we came back in 1944, it was already entirely a different story altogether. At that time, they started preparing already, sending out the whole camp was going to be dissolved and sent people to Russia, to the front, you know, because the war was going on, and to Galicia, which was part of Poland at the time. And we happened to be, our group was many thousands of others, they were sent to Galicia.
Well, when you went back to Cluj?
I went back to Cluj, and I was a free man over there. There was nothing, my mother was home, my sisters, everyone was home.
All four sisters were still home?
All four sisters were still home. The families were all together. It was in December 1943, and we had to go back on the 15th of February 1944.
Huh. Were the conditions at home worse there than when you left before?
Well, the conditions, as far as the conditions are concerned, you could if you had money, you could buy food, and it wasn't as bad as in many other places. What I did find out at a later point, that how it was in Poland and how it was in Czechoslovakia and so on, it wasn't as bad. As I told you before, you know, people are very funny when they get used to something terrible. You know, they get so used to it that they think that this is the best, you know, it is very good. It was terrible, but it wasn't too bad. As long as the families were all together, and unfortunately, we were so misled by our own self, we didn't want to believe it. When we heard stories of what's going on in Poland, what's going on in Czechoslovakia, what's going on in other countries, that say they are actually taking Jews by the thousands, by the hundreds of thousands, and taking them into camps and kill them. We thought that it is just a lie, like many other lies. We didn't realize it. You know, we were, I don't know whether I say dumb or whatever you want to call it, but it was unbelievable what was going on. And the majority of the Jews didn't believe it. So anyway, at this point, would I have known what I know today, I had a chance not once or twice but many a times to cross the border, because my hometown was right near the Romanian border, and in Romania those people were free, you know, and all I would have to do is just cross the border, and I'm in Romania and I'm a free man. But I feared, how do I know that Romania is not going to be worse than what I got here? I know it's bad here, but how do I know what's going on over there? Mm-hmm. And very, very few people had the foresight to make a move like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, very few people had that. And they went back in February 1944 to that camp, and then we were all sent out to different places, like my group with thousands and thousands of others. We were sent to Poland, and I was over there in different localities like Wrochta, Zabie, Kuty, Kolomea, and I don't recall all the bigger cities, you know, and what we were working over there is on the road. We were fixing the roads, and they took us out to build roads. and there were tremendous big forests. And what the Aguinaldos do, they had to cut out trees, and only four men were allowed to a tree. Now those trees were unbelievable, you know, they were really hard to lift them up, and they had to cut out the branches and carry them, four guys to one tree, and we had to carry them uphill and lay them down to build the road. You know, and this takes weeks and weeks and weeks to build a road of I don't know how many miles. You know, it was unbelievable. And over there we were under the command of a Hungarian group of soldiers who were like the Marines here, I would say, something in that order. You know, they were actually roughnecks, you know, and they were really trying to give us a very, very difficult, hard time. And several of us died over there in that camp, because I just couldn't take it. The food was next to zero, and the work was incredible, absolutely incredible. You know, it was so hard that I myself, you know, as I told you before, you know, I'm not a weakling, I wasn't a weakling at that time, and I don't know how I survived. I really, many a times I'm thinking about it, how did I do it that I'm still here? It was impossible, the work you had to do over there. But evidently I survived because I'm here to tell you the story.
Was it winter or was it?
This was already spring and summer of 1944. In the meantime, we heard over there, we heard stories that our parents were all taken to concentration camps. But we didn't have the slightest idea what a concentration camp means, or how it looks like, or what it looks like, but we just heard stories. All I know that we kept on writing letters, and we never received any mail from home.
Did you get any, ever get any of those postcards that they were made to send?
No.
When they got to Auschwitz?
One of my friends, one in a group of 100 probably, received a postcard, and it is that all they said that we are in Waldsee, that's what they call in Waldsee, and we are having a wonderful time, we are all together, and hope that you are doing fine, and hope to see you soon. Fine. And that again gave us a lift, you know, that we know that they are still in existence, and they are still alive, and they are okay. So, this was in 1944. I did not receive a card like that. But as I told you, one of my friends did get one. Probably in the camp there were several others who did receive that I don't know of.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the only one that I know of in our camp who did receive one. And is it getting funny?
Oh, sorry, I have lots of tape.
Oh. And then we were there till 1944, around September, beginning of September, and all of a sudden they told us that I have to go back because this is something very important that I want to bring out. While we were in this camp, and as I told you that many of us died over there of hunger, heart, labor, and so on, one day, it must have been in July of 1944, that there was, by the time we got in to the camp from the work place where we were working, there were rumors that a new commanding officer came in, who was a lieutenant And he must have been something, a terrible, terrible man. And we thought that this might be the end of us. We didn't know what it was all about. And we had supper, and right after we were through eating, they gave us some hot soup or whatever, you know, something like that. And after we were through eating, then all of a sudden they gave an order that everybody who ever, even the sick people, have to come out because some new officer is taking over and he wants to see the whole group together. And in that particular camp, we were 250 people, and he was in charge of this 250 people, and he came outside. I'll never forget him as long as I live. He was a very handsome, tall, strong man, and he introduced himself. His name is Dr. Mazay. Dr. Mazay Istvan. That was his name. He was a lieutenant in uniform, actually, and he is taking over the command of this whole group. And he would like to know if there are any complaints, anybody had any complaints about the food or about the treatments or what's going on in the camp. And naturally, nobody made a move. And he says, you don't have to worry, because if I tell you nothing is going there is no harm being done by anybody stepping out and just telling me exactly what's going on, because I got to know, and I take over, I want to know what's going on. And there was one fellow by the name Riederman. He is in New York right now, an electrician, and he was a really tall guy, and he steps out and he says, yes, sir, he says, I was beaten up today, and he pointed exactly at the soldiers who beat him up. He was a little short fellow, you know, and he says, he beat me up. He says, how did he beat you up? He says, you're so small and you are such a big man. He says, well, it is very simple. When he has the gun and he has a stick in his hand and hits you in your face, and he says, you can see for yourself, and he has a red mark right here on his face. He says, then there is not much that you can do, no matter how big you are. He says, why did he do it to you? He says, because I'm a Jew. That's why. He says, you sure that's the only reason? He says, I'm positively sure, because I'm a hard worker and a good worker, so that wasn't the reason that he hit me, because I wasn't working fast enough or hard enough, because I'm Jewish. Anybody else who was beaten up today, at this point, half of the group stepped out. You know, he was the one who started. Half of them stepped up, and they all said that, yes, I was beaten up, and then he didn't question it any further. And then in front of all of us, he turned to the soldiers, because they were out there on the street, you know, and he told them, he said, now if this year will happen again, he said, I want to know about anything what's going on that at work, what was going on